decade on 102.5 The Bridge.
Back to December 1980. My special guest today live on the programme not only shares a birthday with my daughter, but is an English musician who gained popularity as the lead singer of the post-punk group Adam and the Ants, and later as a solo artist, scoring 10 UK top 10 hits from 1980 to 1983, including 3 number ones. He's also worked as an actor, appearing in over 2 dozen films and television episodes from 1985 all the way to 2003. We welcome to 102.5 The Bridge, Adam from Adam and the Ants. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning.
How are you?
Very well, how are you?
Not too bad, thank you. Thanks for joining us. Before we have a natter, let us remind ourselves of the music that is Adam and the Ants. you make me feel old and take me back. Adam, that takes me back to a lovely time of the 80s.
It makes me feel old. Yeah, it takes me back to the rehearsal room last week when I was I'm doing rehearsing a couple of those songs, Kings of Empty Music.
Absolutely.
I'm trying to get them right.
So let us go back to the beginning of your musical career. How did it all begin for you?
Well, it began in London, in the clubs in London in sort of 77. We did our first gigs around August 77, and it was all happening in London. And I'd seen the Sex Pistols about 18 months before at the St Martin's College of Art. I just thought, something's happening here. So we just played literally anytime, anywhere. We just played all the clubs in London, Mount Marquee and Vortex and stuff. And then regionally came up all around the country and some of Europe. So it was just playing wherever we could.
And the rest is history.
Yeah.
Who were your musical influences back then?
Very varied, really. I mean, at home, my mum used to play Sinatra and Johnny Mathis and all the sort of ballad singers and stuff, so that was all going in. And we had a lady used to come and look after me, babysit, and she liked Gene Vincent and Eddie Cochran and Elvis. And then later on with me, I very much was interested in, glam rock, so it was like really Roxy Music for my favourite band of all of them. I thought they offered something a bit different. It was kind of art rock. They cover, the lyrics were wonderful in it, and everyone looked forward to the new album cover. And so that would, I'd say they were my big influences. And people like Jonathan Richman in the USA, Modern Lovers, people like that. And yeah, so I've always been a music lover. So I learned from those who heard before.
So you're more of a 70s child than an 80s child, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is, Adam and the Ants always get collared with this new romantic thing, which we certainly weren't. There was nothing new or romantic about it. So, I'd say post-punk is more, sits easy with me. But I think, there was something very exciting happened in Great Britain in 1970, late 76, early 77, that I think was possibly the last great effort creatively that really was a whole sort of movement that really changed a lot of stuff.
How would you describe your genre of music? Would you put it in that category, in the kind of punk music?
I'd say punk, post-punk. We were pretty much, we started out working with Susie and the Banshees. We used to go out with them. We were the support band on with Susie, because quite simply Susie Sue didn't have a back line. They didn't have their own instruments and we did. So they'd lend our amplifiers and borrow our drums and everything, and I became very good friends with Kenny Morris, their drummer. It wasn't let's say, welcomed by a lot of people, but I think that edge, that idea that, you had to, do these concerts when not everybody was loving it, and you had to sort of prove yourself, made it last, really, because I still, every night, I still imagine I'm on stage in somewhere in some club somewhere in 1977. It keeps me on my toes,
When that gig circuit, there was the Vortex, wasn't it, that you mentioned on your website, the Roxy and the Marquee, venues like that?
Sadly all closed now.
Yes.
There's only one club left in London, and that's the 100 Club, which I actually went back to a year ago, virtually. In the next couple of days, last year I did the Hammersmith Apollo.
Mm-hmm.
We sold that out. We did the Dirk Wears White Socks, the first album in sequence, but also I did an extra show at the 100 Club where I did a kind of homage to Elvis, his 68 comeback, and I invited the players that played that night and a couple of guests like John Ellis from the Vibrates to come and have a sit down, and I filmed that, and that's going to come out on Record Store Day as a DVD. So, it's a shame, because the 100 Club's the only one left, and it's not necessarily the best one. The Marquee, I thought, was a wonderful club.
It was.
It all started for me at the 100 Club, the Marquee, in Wardour Street, with a residency that I used to play every Tuesday night, and it kind of built from there. That was the real opportunity I had that sadly young bands haven't got.
I think there was the Lyceum as well, wasn't there? That was in London as well.
We sold that out. I mean, before we had a hit record, we were selling the Lyceum out, and sort of two nights at the Empire, the Electric Ballroom in Camden, which is still open. I think it's tragic, really. I mean, even Denmark Street, they've knocked that down, which historically I think is worth keeping, because that was Tin Pan Alley. I wrote all my albums down there in the basement down there. You know, all the artists used to write their songs down there, you know, from the Beatles and the Stones, all used to write, and they're just knocking that all down. So there's a campaign out at the moment to kind of stop that happening.
And then you got that deal with Decca, which produced a batch of demos. Young Parisians was one, wasn't it?
I mean, that I did the double A-side, really, and I should have... Really, Lady would have been the one that would have been most appropriate, because that's like a fast one, but I put Young Parisians out quite deliberately to try and, you know, show that it wasn't going to be the normal four-to-the-floor fare. But I think with new bands, you know, the way I'm approaching it is there are a lot of really good bands out there, so... After the Hammersmith show last year, I did four nights at a lovely venue called the Islington Assembly Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And I put on two new bands a night. So over the four nights, I put on eight new bands. And on this tour, I'm taking two young bands, Shoes and Of Empires. But they're just two. But there were bands like, you know, Night Engine, Savage Nomads, Caesars, Missy LaPink, you know, the you know, Telegram. And some of those bands are now headlining their own the enemy festivals and stuff. So really, I think it's for the artists to actually take out young bands, and that's the only opportunity they've got to get in scene now, you know. And if you can do that, it's a lovely feeling to do it, because I like them. But I checked 60 bands to get eight.
And then the back of the Xerox tour came the Dirk Wears White Socks album, a debut album, brilliant album. I was listening to it this week to remind myself of the music that was on there, and I've forgotten all about it. And I remember that track, Never Trust a Man with an Egg on His Face.
Mm, yeah.
Where did the title of that come from?
Well, I was living in a very, very small room. I call it a room. It wasn't really. It was actually billed as a half-landing flat. It was a broom cupboard. It was literally about 5 foot wide by about 12 foot long, but I loved it. I wrote all of Dirk in there, and actually Arthur Kings of Wild Frontier in there. But I was watching this science fiction film on this tiny little television set I had, and there was a thing about this monster from outer space, and it looked like an omelette. And so I kind of got the idea, and I like science fiction.
Yes.
So I thought I'd put a slot, and also it was a slow song. I mean, I think Dirk Wears White Socks, obviously I'm listening to it myself to, you know, remind myself of what to sing and remember the lyrics, but it's not really a punk record at all. It's quite a jazzy record. I mean, there's seven key changes in one song. There's sort of time changes, and that was, even it's a surprise to me to listen to it now. It really doesn't fit in anywhere, and I think it's taken sort of 35 years exactly for people to start understanding it, including me.
Well, the music scene's so differently now, isn't it? Like with Spotify and iTunes and social media, it's a lot different today than what it was back then.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a change there. I mean, you know, there's this new sort of thing that some of the big artists are getting together, you know, to try and combat that, because I think Spotify and that, all those things, it's all very good, but the people that are giving us that aren't considering the idea that, you know, music is not free to make. You have to pay money to make the record, you know. Mm-hmm. And the way their attitude is, this wonderful global family where everything's free in some kind of utopia, as long as they're making all the cash. And there's got to be a fight back, but it's very hard to police the internet. But I think what that does do, I don't think people realise, when you write a song, I mean, I wrote those songs you just played, and that's what's paying for my, you know, my daughter's education now.
Mm-hmm.
When people download it for free, you don't get that, and so it's probably one of those ideas that, oh well, you know, you're rich enough, but that's not the case. What about the young band? So really, I think the internet has to be policed more, and the Apple's really, you know, it's kind of good that the artists themselves have got together to try and make conditions better for you know, not only the public, but also for the people that write the songs. You know, it costs quite a lot of money to write a song, you know.
It was a lot different in those days, going back to the vinyl days. When did you first learn about your chart position, when the charts came out?
I remember specifically, I was staying, I was in central London, and I was in a basement flat staying with a friend of mine called Jordan, who actually was our manager at the time, and it came through. My manager there was a guy called Falcon Stewart, who sadly passed away. He used to manage X-Ray Specs. And there was some interest from CBS as it was, and our Sony, because they'd heard Car Trouble, and they wanted to sign us, and my publishers at EMI, a guy called Brian Hopkins, he'd actually gone into Sony and said, sign this band, they're going to happen. And then we put out Kings of the Wild Frontier, and that didn't really make the top, and then Dog Eat Dog got to 30, I think got to 39 in the charts, and somebody dropped out of the Top of the Pops show, and we got our slot, and overnight I sold a quarter of a million singles, and that was it. I mean, the rest was history, as it were, and that opportunity to go on Top of the Pops, I think, is sadly missing now. There does need to be a broadcast one weekly show where, you know, the whole family sit around and watch it. You know, everybody watches it. And it's going to be quite hard to do, because basically you can't do it based on the charts, because the charts is all R&B. So I would think it would have to be split into sections where you had, you know, the actual chart itself, but within that, an indie section and, a mature section, like an MR section, and try and have some kind of way so that it was as broad a chart as it was, you know.
Out of all the music that you recorded, do you have a favourite? Is there one that you like performing the most?
Well, they're all like children. It's just you let them out. Once you let them out, they're on their own. But I still love... The thing is, whenever I sing these songs, I'm trying to get them right, because the Adam and the Ants sound, the sound was very much a kind of hybrid. And layers of vocals. I used to do layers of vocals and mix them down. And on Kings of Our Frontier, actually... the track itself, there was 18 tracks of drums out of 24 tracks. So all the vocals, guitars and everything had to be split into the other tracks, because, you know, doing that live is impossible, but we do play 100% live, but you have to kind of get it as close as you can. So every single night I'm singing it, I'm thinking of the original. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, because that could be better. So you're always pushing. But these shows, I'm doing, you know, I'm doing going around doing a dozen shows. We did five in London, and I'm really going back to the places that I, where Dirt Wears White Socks was born as an album, you know, and Norwich and Warwick and Northampton and Manchester. And on Record Store Day, I will be in Liverpool at a record store, as I was last year at Rough Trade and in Soho, to actually be at an independent record store, you know, the DVD and it, vinyl, you mentioned vinyl earlier. I mean, that again is a labour of love, and that is on the growing side of things.
It is, yes.
And I've done, fortunately, I have a very good relationship with Sony, and I plan to remaster and re-release. The next one will be Kings of Our Frontier, because Dirt Wears White Socks was a really good success for me, having my own label, Blue Black Bizarre, but we did it in white vinyl, and it's got posters and stickers from the time in it. It's been remastered, and we're doing the same with King, so we're doing a double gold A-side of Kings of Our Frontier and Anthony's. It'll be released on Record Store Day, and I think that's indicational of, like, the effort that comes from the artist. So when you put a record out, it is like a child, and you've got to, you know, love it, and if you get the opportunity to get it back into the fold and do it again, and you know, it's like a director getting the original footage back from the studio and doing the director's cut. That's exactly what it's like, and that's what I've got license to do. So Kings of Our Frontier will be the next one, and then do the other five.
Now, this Dirk Wears White Socks tour, it continues on Wednesday in Brighton at the Concord. For all our listeners, all the details are on our website, all the W's, thebridgeradio.net, and you can purchase tickets from our website. How did you prepare for such a tour?
It's a bit like a boxer, really. I was very lucky to do some training with Chris Eubank a couple of years ago, and he gave me a few tips on how to sort of keep fit and stay in shape. So it's really, I look at it as the rehearsals are done, you've got the kind of 30, 40 songs in your head, then it comes to the physical side. So it's almost like getting ready for a contest. So, you know, I started, you know, 6 weeks ago getting myself sorted, mainly walking. I've got a dog. I've got two dogs, actually, but it's great to go out and walk them every day. Walking's very good. It clears my mind, and just then I do a sort of light training routine at home, which is more or less stretching and lifting very light weights at home. So I don't like gymnasiums at all. I don't like them at all. I think they're horrible places. You know, they're intimidating, and I don't like them at all. So I've worked out a system of my own, but it's good to have a focus and a deadline.
Yes, yes. As we say, it starts on Wednesday in Brighton, then there's Southampton, Bristol, Reading. You're here in the Midlands at Wolverhampton on the 16th at the Civic Hall, then Manchester, Liverpool, as you mentioned, Norwich, Leeds, Nottingham, Warwick and Northampton. A busy month. And then you're off abroad somewhere?
Yeah, I might take a little break after that, but then the next thing is I'm working now on the Kings of Our Frontier box set, and I've just finished the last track of my new album, which will be out probably early next year, called Bravest of the Brave. That's 13 new songs that I've written and produced. So there's kind of three things going at the same time. You have to, sounds a lot, but you just have to work in kind of sequence, really. So it keeps me busy, keeps me out of trouble.
Yes, we wish you every success with this tour. When you're in Wolverhampton, give us a wave. We'll always be on the front row. We'll give you a wave. It's the 16th of April here in Wolverhampton at the Civic Hall. For all our listeners, I say the ticket details for all the venues are on our website, all the W's, thebridgeradio.net. Adam from Adam and the Ants, we wish you every success. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, and I wish everybody a happy Sunday, and have a rest like I am today.
So thanks for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you in the Midlands very, very shortly. Cheers.
Thanks very much. Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
About to kick off the Dirk Wears White Sox tour. All ticket details are on our website, thebridgeradio.net. Alternatively, head over to the Big Decades blog, thebridgeradio.net/bigdecades. And there's links there on you can purchase tickets to see Adam and the Ants. Here in the Midlands, he's here, of course, on Wolverhampton Civic Hall on the 16th of April. And he takes in Northampton, Warwick, Nottingham, Leeds, Norwich, Liverpool, Manchester, Reading, Bristol, Southampton and Brighton. I say all tickets are on our website. And it's going to be a brilliant tour. Adam and the Ants.